Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Saints Hour. Mike Haas, along with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis. And Mickey, that's I don't know how you would have drawn it up any differently, but what a great way to start. And 2-0, and maybe this team was under the radar some. I don't know if 91 points, you can stay under the radar, but anyway, it is what it is, and that is a great start for this organization.
Yeah, obviously it's better than the alternative, number one. And look, I think coming out of training camp, we were optimistic. Obviously, there's some things that have to be proven, but it's looked good so far in terms of how the rosters come together. Some of these young guys are playing well. The veterans that are on our team have taken to this, offensive scheme, and things have fallen our way. But it's two games. We've got 15 more to go and a long road. And I think the most important thing here is that our guys understand that they're not going to get overly excited about the start. They're going to be focused on our opponent this week, I know it's a cliche about one game at a time, but it's a cliche for a reason.
And you don't have to go far if you're looking for a marker. And I agree with you. This is a veteran team with the DeMario Davises and guys like that and Cam Jordan. But hey, this team was 2-0 in this exact same situation last year. So you don't have to go far to say, look, this is two games. We got 15 more to go.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's exactly right. And look, there's teams that start the other way and they've been able to turn it around at times. So again, in the preseason, we weren't getting a lot of love from the national media, and we didn't listen to that. And we're not going to listen to it now when they're telling us how great we are.
And my assumption is you guys were okay with that. You went to Irvine, not a lot other than we had a ton of local coverage, but because of the way the NFL is, there wasn't a ton of national coverage, but I kind of felt like you guys got your work done. It didn't bother you at all. And if anything, maybe you got a little chip on the shoulder, but I essentially didn't bother you, right?
Well, it doesn't bother me. In fact, I kind of prefer it. So, I don't think that, and really, I don't think it affects teams in the NFL, whether you're being told how great you are or how bad you are. I think organizations, players, coaches are professional enough to put that aside and understand that it doesn't mean anything.
And I will say, and this is not a question because I'll just say it and get it out there, but I think it's going to be the same thing this week. When the victory over Carolina was, Carolina's not as good. Of course you beat them. And then Dallas was, the focus was on the Cowboys. And maybe the Cowboys weren't as good as we thought they were. And this week it's going to be, oh my gosh, the Eagles, it'll be all Eagles. It will not be anything about the Saints. So again, there's not a question there. Just throwing it out there because I think it's going to be the same thing this week. Had to be fun, because it was for me, to be in Arlington at that stadium in the second half. And you could really feel Saints fans making an impact there at the stadium.
I think anytime we play, particularly in the southern region, I feel like we have a lot of Saints fans that travel and show up at our games. And look, if we're successful, you're going to hear from them at the end of the game, just like you would. Even at our games, I think there's probably going to be a contingent of Philadelphia fans at our game this weekend, and hopefully we can keep them quiet.
Yeah, I think Philly's probably happy to be not having to play at Lincoln Financial this week. I have to wait and see. Is there the stats are just, they're gaudy. I don't know what else to say. Is there anything that sticks out for you, whether it's clearly the run game, offensive line, the turnovers? Is there a stat out there that you have looked at through two games that kind of sticks out for you?
Well, I mean, the obvious thing is just, our first team offense being so efficient. There's just not enough, we haven't played enough games to read anything into it. In 2011, we had six games where we scored 40 points or more. In 2018, we had six games where we scored 40 points or more. So And look, we had 10 games in 11 that we scored 30 or more. And in 18, I think, as I recall, it was the same 10 games where we scored 30 or more. So I think we're used to scoring a lot of points. But when you're scoring a lot of points, look, the key is, are you holding the opponent to less than that? And so I just think, look, it's too early, too few games to get really excited and overread and overreact into the way any team performs at this point.
I guess just your overall thoughts about, the Clint Kubiak system. We watched it in training camp, but when you're up against each other, it's hard. And then in the preseason, you're not really showing it. I guess just your overall thoughts as to, again, it's like, he's like the quarterback, right? If it works, he's a genius. If it doesn't, he's not. But, and so it is what it is, but it has been, and even Dennis has talked about it a couple of times, in that you can still feel that the other teams don't know, we have one offensive kind of system for such a long time. They're still kind of feeling out, and adjusting to this offense. Just your thoughts about the new system.
Yeah. Well, I think this, look, I like the balance that we've exhibited so far, but you've said that correctly, is that, look, if it's working, then it feels like everybody's a genius. And if it's not, it feels like nobody knows anything. And I think the important thing is, with any offensive scheme, does it fit your personnel? And is it a scheme that can adjust to the talents of the players that you have? It's look, we're trying to put, and our coaches are trying to put players in position to be successful. And you do that by putting them in a position of asking them to do things that they do well, and the things that they don't do well, not asking that of them very often. And so I think our coaches are doing a good job in that regard.
When you're building this team, and the team, it was just in place, of course, but you build in this offseason, can you take an offensive system like Ken Kubiak, this is the system, and you guys learn it? Or do you vice versa, you go, okay, this is the system, let's get the players that work with this system? Or does the system come first and the players adapt?
Well, look, when you have the way the NFL is and the contracts that are in place, look, we have, a lot of our guys were in place already. And so there's it's probably a little bit of both, to be honest with you. But I think, look, when you go through the interview process, and when Clint is going through his evaluation process of, does he want to come? He's going to look at the roster and say, hey, look, these are guys that I want to work with. These guys have the kind of talent that and skill sets that I'm looking for in order to run the scheme that he wants to. And so it's a two-way street, really.
Derek Carr clearly finished up the end of 2023 strong, winning 4 of the last 5. Touchdowns to interceptions was strong. His completion rate was 75%, and really kind of picked that up where he was, which is kind of hard to do. And just 5 touchdowns. He had one sack in each game, but for 1 yard. Your thoughts about his play and how he's kind of adapted? Because to me, he's the guy that started all 17 games last year, and he was hurt. He battled through. Just your thoughts about how he has adapted and kind of taken, the shots that quarterbacks take in the NFL, both on the field and off the field, and he's handled it very well.
Yeah, look, last year, you mentioned it earlier, we started off 2-0, and Derek's doing well, and then he gets hurt. And look, to his credit, he played through. He played through that when a lot of people wouldn't, and that's to his credit. But it didn't really allow him to put his best foot forward in the middle part of that season last year. And then he got feeling better and obviously got more comfortable with not just the offense, but the players on this team, and played pretty well at the end of last season. And I think he's carried that forward in terms of his personal play. And I think that's a big part of it. Obviously, he's worked his butt off to adapt to what Clint is asking him to do. develop a rapport with the receivers and the backs that we have, and look, it's paid off so far, and that's really, you know, a credit to him and our coaches, and the way and the amount of work that they've put in. And look, you know, in terms of you know, the other stuff, if you're the quarterback of an NFL team, you're going to get a lot of flowers when things go well, and you're going to get a lot of criticism when they don't. It just comes with the job. That's part of the reason they get paid so much, right?
It does seem to go with the job for sure.
Yeah, and look, the you know, fans and the media in this day and age, in particular, they don't look beyond, you know, the wins and losses. They're not, honestly, it's just not sophisticated enough to look beyond that oftentimes. And so, but again, it's just part of the territory.
We are speaking with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis. And I don't know if what role you have in this, but this has got to be the toughest job in the world, and that is to pick the Saints Fan of the Year. The Saints have joined forces with Keesler Federal Credit Union to celebrate the ultimate Saints fan. So, and the winner is going to receive an all-expense-paid trip to the Super Bowl 59 right here in New Orleans at Caesars Superdome. So you get to nominate fans. You got to go to the Saints website, NewOrleansSaints.com/fans, Saints Fan of the Year. So you nominate someone who inspires others with their love for Saints football, and I can think of, right, 66,000 pretty much off the top that are going to be in that number. Interesting kind of contest you have here, and this was a tough one, right, having to pick one? It's like picking your favorite child, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I don't have anything to do with it, fortunately, because, yeah, there's going to be thousands and thousands of great candidates for that title.
Again, go to the Saints website, NewOrleansSaints.com/fans, Saints Fan of the Year. And while we're kind of here, because I just mentioned it, you did get to see your son, Alex Loomis, who started with the Saints, worked his way up. Now he's the Dallas Cowboys Director of Pro Scouting, has been since 2017. I'm just curious as to the dynamic, I guess, just during the regular season or during the offseason. I mean, he's your son, you talk all the time, but does that dynamic change at all the week prior to the game or, you know, day of the game, anything like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, he's been with the Cowboys for 15 years, and he never actually worked for us except when he was in college at LSU, I might add. He worked in training camp for us, but we don't talk a lot about football. Occasionally, if he has conversations, it might be with our, you know, our pro director, Michael Parenton, or, you know, his counterpart here, when they're talking about players that you know, they have an interest in that was with us or vice versa. So that there might be some opinion exchange from them. But for us, it's I try not to put him in that position ever of, you know, talking about football. Look, I know he's probably pissed off, to be honest with you, that they lost to us. I would be if we lost to them. And yet, you know, you put your head down and you go to work, because there's another game coming up quickly.
And final question, and we'll bring in Chris Long into this conversation, but this is about Taliese Fuaga, your starting left tackle, the rookie. And we talked at the start of Irvine at camp and some during it, but I don't think I've ever seen a rookie kind of come in so seamlessly. Maybe it's because he's an offensive lineman. Didn't have to go in front of the media for the first couple of weeks. He just kind of got to learn his way, and he certainly played his way, earned the respect of his teammates, which was huge. And I think even Dennis said he just kind of matured beyond his age. But I mean, you can't ask for a whole lot more than what you've seen out of that kid, huh?
Yeah, you know, he's been really good so far. You know, to his benefit, we haven't had to drop back and just throw it in obvious situations where the defense can pin their ears back and just come. So he's benefited from that, certainly. But look, we've had some offensive linemen come in early, play early, be mature. You know, Jari Evans comes to mind. Like, you know, the day he walked on campus, it was obvious he was ready to play in the NFL, even though you wouldn't have expected it from Bloomsburg. And, you know, our coaches did a great job of preparing him, but there was a maturity and a confidence there that he had. And obviously, Taliesin is off to a good start, and you feel some of those same qualities. And there's been other guys too. Charles Bentley was a guy and like that. So, but yeah, he's off to a really good start. We're excited about, you know, the offensive line and how they've played these first two games. And yet again, it's two games in.
When we come back, we will be joined by former All-Pro defensive end Chris Long, son of Howie Long. You are listening to the Saints Hour here on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. Welcome back to the Saints Hour. Mike Costa, along with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis. We are pleased to be joined now by Chris Long, the number one pick, second pick of the first round by the Rams, played All-Pro defensive end for the Eagles, Rams, Patriots, one of only six players to win consecutive Super Bowls for two different teams. And as a parent, most important to me, the Walter Payton NFL Man of the Year in 2018. So that's very cool. Chris Long joins us. Chris, welcome to the show. And I know you and Mickey know each other already. Just what are your thoughts on this Saints team? I know you do a lot of analysts. You have a podcast, The Green Light. Your thoughts on this Saints 2-0 start?
Well, I think it's been a lot of fun to watch. I mean, watching this offense, this guy Kubiak. Hey, Mickey, how much can you pay this guy to stay in house over the next few years?
Right.
You know, I mean, this dude comes in and Derek looks rejuvenated. You know, there wasn't enough play action. You know, there wasn't enough window dressing. There wasn't enough of the kind of runs that I like seeing Alvin in last year. And I think seeing the way that offense performed against Dallas, you know, Carolina, you got a lot of pent up aggression. You take it out on these guys. They're going through a lot and you're thinking, okay, maybe the Saints are just beating up on a young quarterback. But to get Dallas, whose defense made Cleveland look like, you know, they didn't know how to play football a week ago, and it totally flipped to your side of the ledger. And I think a lot of it has to do with you walk into the building, and I know Penning is coming along, and I know, you know, you've got some rookies up front. To keep Micah Parsons and Tank from wrecking the game alone is an incredible accomplishment for any offense going into that building. But to have them so off balance that every shot you took, it felt like you hit.
But you're right. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, look, I thought, you know, Dallas moved the ball pretty well on us. There wasn't a lot of work for the punters in that game.
No.
And yet we were able to, when they got down the red zone, we were able to hold them field goals as opposed to touchdowns. That's really important. But, I was talking to our coaches after the game, and, you know, one of the things that I think is true is that when you get a big lead, it's hard to play defense sometimes, because what you don't realize is, okay, your mindset goes from defending every blade of grass to, hey, we don't want to give up a big play. And so, look, there's a lot of yardage that gets gained in games like that against the defense. And then afterwards you think, well, the defense didn't play that well. Well, I think they played pretty well.
Yeah.
You know, you're keeping them out of the end zone. It's a 4-point play on third down when you're in the red zone. And I thought our guys did a great job of that.
But that's so true. You know, making the adjustment to playing with a lead, you know, coverage is going to be a little bit softer and you're going to give a little bit more. And so, you know, those guys will learn. It's a good problem to have, not knowing, you know, how to do that and then having to learn it. I'd rather have to learn that than never get to learn it. Like, let's learn to play with a lead. I think these guys will be good.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is your perspective about it feels like, particularly at the beginning of this year and a good part of last season, is that, you know, the emphasis for the last, you know, 10, 15, 20 years has been on the passing game, right? And all of a sudden, yeah, it feels like that's flipping a little bit and the run game is kind of getting their due around our league.
Yeah, I think there's like a differentiating factor if you actually know how to run the ball. Like it's like a life jacket or something, you know. It's like New England's going through a big, you know, turnover. You watch them the first two games, they get in 13 personnel, put a big tight end out there, and they're coming downhill. And, you know, there's a lot of teams that aren't used to fitting up power run schemes, gap scheme stuff. And, you know, I think that's even more so coming out of college. You see less and less of it. So it does, you know, things are cyclical. I'm not saying it's going to swing back to like a Paul Johnson thing. Every team's going to run the option. But I do think, you know, coming out of camp, the passing game is more timing predicated. And one thing we don't need a lot of time to get used to doing as defensive linemen is putting our hand in the dirt and going 100 miles an hour. So rushers are as good as ever. Offensive lines have less time than ever to do probably the hardest job on the field. And quarterbacks and receivers aren't on the same page. But I also think, Mickey, like, there's a lot of really established programs that are going through change and dealing with challenges, you know, from Kansas City to Cincinnati to San Francisco, busy off seasons, injuries. So it'll take time.
I'm sure you've been asked about this a bunch. What's your thoughts on the new kickoff?
I'm getting used to it. You know, I play Madden a lot, you know, and when I first saw it on the screen, I play with the Saints a lot too, by the way. And I really do. And I saw it and I was like, this looks so messed up. But, you know, the NFL is always trying to do the safe thing if they can. And they're always trying to keep the points being scored. And I think when they looked at average drive start, if I had to guess, they're like, hey, if we can get drives pushed out a little further while featuring some players that you don't usually get to see returning kicks and more exciting plays, and it's less big collisions, like, it's hard for me to argue with it. I'm the guy who's going to fight to the death to keep the chain gang. Like, I like old school stuff. So it's hard for me to lose the nostalgia of seeing all those guys take off at the same time with the flyover, the fireworks overhead. But I think it's a better play for the future of the game.
Yeah. And so if you're coaching a team, are you a guy that's kicking the ball into the end zone, or are you forcing them to return it?
It depends on who's back there for sure. You know, I tend to, when I'm the Saints, I kick it in the end zone. I say our defense is going to get it done on Madden.
I got it.
Would you kick the Shaheed?
We've been a team that.
No, you would not kick the Shaheed. You would not kick the Shaheed. By the way, that guy, that's a number two right there. Come on. That guy's gonna catch a lot of balls this year.
Yeah, he's done a good job, obviously. You know, we're a team that's kicked. We've basically been forcing our opponent to return balls. But I think a lot of teams, I've seen a lot of teams, you know, just kick it right in the end zone and just start on the 30. It's an interesting philosophy, how you look at it, you know, whether you want to force them to return it or not.
I try to get aggressive too, though. I think it's cool to get these kickers that can actually place the ball. And I don't think we've seen enough of those chances being taken. But as soon as we get like more of a subset of like what's going on out there, I think you'll see more funky stuff.
When we come back, more with former defensive end, two-time Super Bowl winner Chris Long and Mickey Loomis, Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager, here on the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. We are talking with longtime defensive end, former All-Pro Chris Long, who won a Super Bowl with the Patriots and won a Super Bowl with the Eagles, beating the Patriots. And that's where we're about, I don't know, 20 some minutes into the show. We've not mentioned Philadelphia and Atlanta last night. So I watched your podcast this morning and there's a lot to digest, but because you know, you're in the same studio, my favorite part was the end of the game frustrated you so much that you walked out of the house with the remote control. Exactly.
My wife just texted me, like, can you bring the remote? I woke up this morning. She's like, where's the remote control? I'm trying to watch a show with June, our one-year-old daughter. She just texted me again. So, yeah, that was an issue. And, yeah, that's rough. But I think if we're asking a lot of Jalen Hurts, you know, to whom much is given, much is expected, and I think Kellen Moore had a great week one. I'd like to see some better decision-making in the red zone. In general, and I think, like, you know, the first four down situation, it's third and three, tuck it and run or keep the ball on the ground. You've been pounding the ball the whole drive. Saquon taps his helmet and you give it to Kenny Gainwell and run into two heavy boxes or one heavy box. Just keep running the ball then. So I have no issue with them throwing the ball to their MVP candidate running back in the flat. It's the right call. If you remember, Shane Steichen last year went to the flat in a game where it was on the line against Houston, basically for the division. It's the right call. In that situation, you're like, maybe I don't trust Minshew, but this is Jalen Hurts throwing to Saquon. You know, I think you'd do it 10 out of 10 times and it was schemed up properly. The thing that drove me crazy is the pass rush. And what gets me is, as a former player, I spent so much time charging myself up to go do it. You know, like in my head, I was wound up in a ball. And I felt like even if I wasn't very good some days, I was scratching and clawing. And that's what you have to do as a rush group to try to survive in the NFL. And I don't feel like they came out with that attitude, even though they're not what they were last year. Jalen Carter's got to win a one-on-one, you know, and if you get play action, you got to transition. So it sounds simple, but the fix is not simple. You know, it's either the unit has to play a lot better, or if that's your best, that's an admission that we got worse there. And that's going to be a problem.
Well, can you hold those thoughts and not pass those on to them for at least a week?
Hey, you know, I made a joke last night, Mickey. I was like, I don't know, maybe you could trade for Hassan Reddick. You know, like, he's out there right now. I don't know, man. It's so easy for me as a 39-year-old who tries to struggle at night to find the right sleeping position to think, it can't be that hard. Just time up that head bob and go sink that long arm in there and somebody win, man. You know, that's a good offensive line, but there'll be better ones.
Yeah.
Not a question for you, Chris, and we appreciate your time. You went to school in Charlottesville, Virginia, went to University of Virginia. I worked in Charlottesville, went to James Madison. I love,
right on.
Love Charlottesville, Virginia. Go. And 2017, you donated your entire salary that year in the NFL to different charitable organizations. How did that come about? How did it work out, really? Because now we've had some time.
Yeah, you know what? It was a thing where, to be honest, I was late going on starting a foundation in my career. I was doing a lot of stuff kind of on the low because I don't want to be, you know, look at me, I'm doing good things guy, which that's a line to walk. But my heart's in the right place and I always want to do good things. And I had a lot of teammates who did too. So I started a foundation, and really what that taught me was the fans are the biggest tool we have, like, to doing good. Like, the fans will get behind what you do. And so I was kind of struggling to find purpose coming back. I was 2017 was not all roses for me. You know, I'm starting with a new team. There were some moments there where I was like, what am I doing? You know, do I need to keep going? And these things all kind of culminated, conversations I was involved in about, you know, social justice causes. And for me, like, one of the best ways that we can advance the ball forward when it comes to equality in this country is educate our youth equitably and with all we got. And so I got behind that deal, and I said, you know, how could I rally people to do the thing that I learned they know how to do, and that's lift up our causes. And I said, well, if I play for free, you know, Marvin Demoff and them broke me off a few years back, and I'm living good, man, so I don't need this money. And for me, it would make this year really special. You know, like, to show up at work in the morning, I'm not going to complain about anything. I'm not just playing for myself. I'm playing for a promise I made. So selfishly, it worked out well for me because it lit a fire under my ass a little bit, but it also, it did a lot of good, raising awareness and actually, like, getting an opportunity to get in that space, because 5-7 years later, actually, like, we've really done a lot more in the ed equity space. And if I'd not done that year, I don't think I'd be here, you know, doing what we're able to do.
Well done.
Chris is one of the few guys, you know, a lot of guys say, man, I play this game for free. He actually did it.
Right. I wouldn't go to meetings for free, but that was the hard part. But the games, I'd play them right now for free. Yeah.
Very, very impressive.
Awesome. Thanks for your time.
Yeah. Thanks for your time.
Guys.
Now,
yeah.
I would
yeah,
suggest you probably take the remote back to your wife now.
I'm going to do that. That's the first thing, brother. Yeah, I was about to forget. You know, you're my guy, Hoss.
Game's been long over now. She can watch her shows now. Chris All Long, right, we appreciate your time. Thanks, bud.
See y'all.
Take care, Chris.
Let's pause 10 seconds to let stations identify themselves here on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. When we come back, we will bring in former offensive lineman and NFL analyst, as well as an analyst on the national radio broadcast, Brian Baldinger. This is the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. Welcome back to the Saints Hour. Mike Hoss, along with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis, and now joined by Brian Baldinger, who played for the Dallas Cowboys, Indianapolis, and Philadelphia. And he will do our game this Sunday with the Eagles. He's with the national radio broadcast. And Mickey, the floor is yours.
Well, look, I want to start off by asking Brian about 1982. I want to take him back. He's an undrafted free agent, right, with the Cowboys?
Yeah.
And look, that's the era that I started with the Seahawks, and I want you to relay. You know, we all know what undrafted free agency looks like now for these college guys, but with roster limits, how many guys were in that camp? Because I know how many were.
Yeah.
And I just want you to talk about that a little bit.
You know, Mickey, it was a different era, obviously, so it's hard to compare. But that year, I was one of 110 free agents. And we had, you know, it was 12 rounds in 82. But we had a couple picks in a couple different rounds. We had 15 rookies drafted. We had a draft class of 125 rookies. And honestly, Mick, for the first 3 weeks of training camp, I literally all I did was look at whatever card they put up in front of me, whatever card they put up, I ran the card drill against our number one defense or number two defense. I ran 32 zone plays in a row every morning, 16 against the number one defense, 16 against the number two defense. And that's what I was. I was a card drill guy. And then what we would do, what Landry would do back then was after you finish the afternoon practice, all the rookies would scrimmage. So you'd get done practice, and then we would scrimmage for, you know, 20, 30 plays. And so it was just, it was like the ultimate, like, survivor pool back then. You know, guys were being cut every single day, and the ranks just kept getting thinner and thinner until that, you know, that final countdown. But it was, you know, you never really forget those 6 weeks back then in training camp.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I know we signed, but that was one of my very first jobs is you know, after the draft, we go out and we'd sign 60 or 70 guys from all walks of life. And in those days, you know, you didn't do it over the phone. You had to travel to go, you know, visit with them. I mean, we had our little recruiting books, and we, you know, kind of explain why they should come to Seattle instead of, you know, Dallas or whatever. And it was really one of my favorite things is giving and having these guys all have this opportunity to live out their dreams. But then they come to camp and there's like a room, a set, you just said it, of 100 guys.
Yeah.
And how am I going to set myself apart in this group?
Well, the real quick funny story for you, Mick, like we didn't actually have enough scouts to sign all the free agents. So they sent anybody in the Cowboys building to go try and sign. So they sent the equipment manager to come sign me, Buck Buchanan. Yeah. And Buck went out there every year. He'd signed. Like when he called me, I was in finals and I couldn't meet with him when he wanted. So he went to North Carolina State, signed somebody, came back after my final, and I negotiated my free agent contract with, I didn't have an agent. I negotiated my free agent contract with Buck Buchanan. I got him from a $500 signing bonus up to a $1,200 signing bonus. And my plea to him was I had a nice Plymouth Fury in the parking lot, but it didn't have any brakes. I needed at least $1,000 to get brakes fixed on it so I could drive it. So I got him. I squeezed him for $1,200 in a 3-year deal, Mickey. So I felt like I won back then.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that was awesome. Yeah. Look, I remember a guy negotiating with me, look, he didn't want more money. He wanted a brand new fishing pole. So we got him a brand new fishing pole.
That's nice. Yeah. There was a little different wants and needs back then, Mick.
Yeah. So another thing I was looking at, and I don't know whether this is true or not, but 1994, I read that you were released in a salary cap move. And so I thought, wow, he might be the very first salary cap casualty in our league, because that came into play in 1993, as I recall.
Yeah, exactly. That was the first year. I think the salary cap, Mickey, you might know, I think it was somewhere around $33 million back then. Now that's a signing bonus for somebody. But, you know, that was the salary cap. And, you know, I was a veteran guy. I wasn't making a lot of money, but they were just, you know, they were, I don't know, we had a couple of guys that they, you know, whatever. So, you know, it was just, it was, I tried to play, you know, try to pass a few physicals in some other places. Probably good that I didn't pass those physicals and got a chance to move on.
When we come back, we'll have more with Brian Baldinger as well as Mickey Loomis, Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager. This is the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. We are talking with Brian Baldinger, 1982 to 93, offensive lineman, Dallas, Indy, Philadelphia. We had spoke with Chris Long earlier, and you're a noted film junkie, right? So, I mean, the board behind you and a lot of your posts and follow a lot of your stuff. Did that come post-playing, or was that always a part of your kind of DNA?
I was always a big film. I mean, back then, you know, we were...
It was actually film.
Well, it was. I mean, we had
tape anyway.
Millimeter films. In fact, to this day, I was at, when I first made Dallas, I was a backup center and guard for the first few years. So I never played center. So I would study the best centers. Like, I still have a 16 millimeter tape, Mickey, of a Monday night game. You might remember this. It was 1984. It was the Dolphins against the Raiders. It was literally Dwight Stevenson, who's the best center I've ever seen, against Howie Long. And I know I must have watched that film. I must have watched that 100 times. I still have it. Just, I mean, I don't have the projector anymore, but I kept the film. I was like, okay, if I'm going to be a center, I'm going to study the best that's ever played. And just watching that match, I mean, Howie will tell you, you just had Chris Long. Howie will tell you that's the best player he ever played against. So, yeah, I mean, it was always that. But then what I found out when I got in this business, I did the games at Fox for like 12 years on TV, and I do national radio now. I'll be down in New Orleans for this game Sunday. You know, as the analyst, I mean, you might have 12 seconds to talk about a play, and maybe you can make a really poignant point about why it worked, it didn't work, or effort or technique or something, but you're very, very limited. And I just found like it was just a real missing component for fans and players.
Look, I'm sure everybody's asked you about this, and I'm going to ask you as well. What's your thoughts on the new kickoff? You like it? Don't like it?
Okay.
Give me your two cents.
All right, Mickey. So I went to 11 training camps this year. Everybody practiced it. Saw a lot of different things. I saw running backs returning. I saw plays that looked like trap plays where they're kicking out. I saw different types of kicks. And so far it's been kind of a big nothing, right? The team seemed pretty content to put it on the 30. But I talked to a special teams coach where I was this weekend, pretty prominent guy. And he said, Baldy, it's going to evolve. The more these special team coaches get their hands on the tape, how they're doing things. So I feel like it's going to evolve as the season goes on.
Yeah, well, we've been a team in these first two games that we've, you know, basically forced the other team to return it. You know, we're kicking it. We're not kicking it through the end zone. And I think, you know, I don't know that the net is that much different, but I do think that there's a benefit to, you know, forcing the other team to return the kick. Now, part of that is who's the returner, right? And do you want to stay away from them? So, like, if you're a head coach, you're an analytical guy, you're a head coach, are you kicking it and putting it at the 30, or are you forcing them to return it?
Well, here's another component to it. I'm kicking it, and I want my kickoff coverage team to go down there and cover the kick. And I want to keep them around the 20-yard line. Like, that's how I'm covering. So I always believe that kickoff coverage is directly related to how you play defense. Most of the guys covering a kick are defensive players. They're aggressive. They want to be involved in a game. They want to make tackles. They want to beat one-on-one blocks. Like, I think it's an extension of your defense and your defensive mentality.
So early part of the season here, I feel like the run game has all of a sudden gotten a little more prominence. You know, we've spent the last 20 years just focused on passing teams. What's your observation with that regard?
Well, I mean, all the numbers say, Mickey, that the passing numbers are way down. The running is up. I saw Houston beat Indianapolis week one. I saw, you know, Joe Mixon carry it 30 times. I've seen that, you know, that running back in San Francisco, he's carried it, you know, 48 times in two games now. I think the guys that have those type of backs right now that can actually wear you down, what Josh Jacobs did the other day for Green Bay, you put a kid Malik Willis back there and you just feed Josh Jacobs. I mean, that looked like the guy that led the league in rushing 2 years ago. He was a difference maker. I just think the amount of bubble screens and, you know, just all the horizontal passing that we're seeing in the league. And I mean, you guys tackled a bunch of, you know, a bunch of that stuff right at the line of scrimmage the other day. Dallas didn't really gain much in any of those plays. Like, if that's the passing game, I'd rather hand it off and work on my double teams and powers and things like that inside and put it on the offensive line rather than putting it on my receivers to go block cornerbacks out there.
Yeah, and look, as I'm going to assume this, that you can expound on it. If you're an offensive lineman, every offensive lineman I've ever met, man, they love running the ball, right? It puts them in an aggressive mindset. And so just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, The people that know when the defense is breaking down first are the offensive linemen. Like nobody, because nobody ever takes getting run on quietly. They're always pointing fingers. They're always bitching. You can break a team's sword by running it down their throats. And no, that's no, the offensive line isn't ever going to celebrate. We're never going to really score, all that stuff. But we know when we are winning the game. We know up front when we're winning it. You got to give us a chance to do it. But we know when we start leaning on these guys, we know, they're not getting off blocks quite as quickly in the fourth quarter as the first quarter. Like, you know when you're wearing a team down. And that's generally when you get the big runs. Like what you did, this weekend against Dallas was punishing what you did, the way that you hit them with three backs and, the runs by Jamal and Kamara at the end of that game. I mean, you wore that team down pretty good. And they did a great job the previous week against Cleveland. So I thought that was a real statement in that game, the way that you ran the ball.
Well, look, we got a Duke left guard for us, right? Lucas Patrick, so that
Yeah.
helped us.
No, he's played well. He's played really well. I mean, it helps that you drafted that kid from Oregon State in the first round. I haven't quite seen a guy come in the league and do that in a while. So Fuaga is he looks special to me, Mick. He really does.
Yeah, as I recall, you liked him. During the draft process, I think I remember you talking about him a little bit. Yeah, he's done a good job, and look, he's benefited because we haven't had to, drop back and throw it a lot in obvious passing situations. So, but he's very mature. It's not an easy transition to go from right to left, and yet he's made it look easy.
Well, it's never easy, but I think he made the two positions stronger. I think Trevor on the right side is better than he was on the left side. He could play his more of his style of football. It's he like just Taliesin, he's just a rare athlete out there. And then his power is just you just don't see that type of power come into this league very often. I mean, that first block against Derrick Brown. Not many people move Derrick Brown in this business. And to see him walk him off the line of scrimmage like he did, it's a testament to, he's going to move people. Him and Lucas, it's a good left side right now. I think Trevor's better on the right side. I've known Caesar a long time. He's a Camden kid here, Mickey. We work out in Lane Johnson's backyard. He's come back from a major injury. I saw him down the field on that screen the other day. I didn't know. I had no idea Caesar could run like that, but that was pretty impressive watching him go down the field.
He's one of these guys that, he loves football, and we showed that play at the team meeting on Monday, and man, he got a lot of cheers when they were showing him running down there with Alvin. It was pretty impressive.
Well, we will see you this weekend. You're part of the national radio team.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate
Thanks,
you.
Mickey. Yep.
That's our show for tonight. Thanks for listening, everyone. And my thanks to Charlie Long in the booth. As always, this has been the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. Welcome back to the Saints Hour. Mike Hoss, along with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis, and now joined by Brian Baldinger, who played for the Dallas Cowboys, Indianapolis, and Philadelphia. And he will do our game this Sunday with the Eagles. He's with the national radio broadcast. And Mickey, the floor is yours.
Well, look, I want to start off by asking Brian about 1982. I want to take him back. He's an undrafted free agent, right, with the Cowboys.
Yeah.
And look, that's the era that I started with the Seahawks. And I want you to relay. We all know what undrafted free agency looks like now for these college guys, but with roster limits, how many guys were in that camp? Because I know how many were.
Yeah.
And I just want you to talk about that a little bit.
Mickey, it was a different era, obviously. So it's hard to compare. But that year, I was one of 110 free agents. And we had, it was 12 rounds in 82. But we had a couple picks in a couple different rounds. We had 15 rookies drafted. We had a draft class of 125 rookies. And
Wow.
honestly, Mick, for the first 3 weeks of training camp, all I did was look at whatever card they put up in front of me, whatever card they put up. I ran the card drill against our number one defense or number two defense. I ran 32 zone plays in a row every morning, 16 against the number one defense, 16 against the number two defense. And that's what I was. I was a card drill guy. And then what we would do, what Landry would do back then was after you finished the afternoon practice, all the rookies would scrimmage. So you'd get done practice, and then we would scrimmage for, you know, 20, 30 plays. And so it was just, it was like the ultimate, like, survivor pool back then. You know, guys were being cut every single day, and the ranks just kept getting thinner and thinner until that, you know, that final countdown. But it was, you know, you never really forget those 6 weeks back then in training camp.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I know we signed, but that was one of my very first jobs is, you know, after the draft, we go out and we'd sign 60 or 70 guys from all walks of life. And in those days, you know, you didn't do it over the phone. You had to travel to go, you know, visit with them. You know, we had our little recruiting books and we, you know, kind of explain why they should come to Seattle instead of, you know, Dallas or whatever. And it was really one of my favorite things is giving and having these guys all have this opportunity to live out their dreams. But then they come to camp and there's like a room, a set, you just said it, of 100 guys.
Yeah.
And how am I going to set myself apart in this group?
Well, the real quick funny story for you, Mick, like we didn't actually have enough scouts to sign all the free agents. So they sent anybody in the Cowboys building to go try and sign. So they sent the equipment manager to come sign me, Buck Buchanan. Yeah. And Buck went out there every year. He'd signed, like when he called me, I was in finals and I couldn't meet with him when he won. So he went to North Carolina State, signed somebody, came back after my final, and I negotiated my free agent contract with, I didn't have an agent. I negotiated my free agent contract with Buck Buchanan. I got him from a $500 signing bonus up to a $1,200 signing bonus. And my plea to him was, I had a nice Plymouth Fury in the parking lot, but it didn't have any brakes. I needed at least $1,000 to get brakes fixed on it so I could drive it. So I got him. I squeezed him for $1,200 in a 3-year deal, Mickey. So I felt like I won back then.
Oh, that was awesome. Yeah. Look, I remember a guy negotiating with me, look, he didn't want more money. He wanted a brand new fishing pole. So we got him a brand new fishing pole.
That's nice. Yeah, there was a little different wants and needs back then, Mickey.
Yeah. So another thing I was looking at, and I don't know whether this is true or not, but 1994, I read that you were released in a salary cap move. And so I thought, wow, he might be the very first salary cap casualty in our league, because that came into play in 1993, as I recall.
Yeah, exactly. That was the first year. I think the salary cap, Mickey, you might know, I think it was somewhere around $33 million. Back then. Now that's a signing bonus for somebody. But, you know, that was a salary cap. And, you know, I was a veteran guy. I wasn't making a lot of money, but they were just, you know, they were, I don't know, we had a couple of guys that they, you know, whatever. So, you know, it was just, it was, I tried to play, you know, try to pass a few physicals in some other places. Probably good that I didn't pass those physicals and got a chance to move on.
When we come back, we'll have more with Brian Baldinger as well as Mickey Loomis, Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager. This is the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. We are talking with Brian Baldinger, 1982 to 93, offensive lineman, Dallas, Indy, Philadelphia. We had spoke with Chris Long earlier, and you're a noted film junkie, right? So, I mean, the board behind you and a lot of your posts and follow a lot of your stuff. Did that come post-playing, or was that always a part of your kind of DNA?
I was always a big film. I mean, back then, you know, we were...
It was actually film.
Well, it was. I mean, we had
the tape anyway.
Millimeter films. In fact, to this day, when I first made Dallas, I was a backup center and guard for the first few years. So I never played center. So I would study the best centers. Like, I still have a 16-millimeter tape, Mickey, of a Monday night game. You might remember this. It was 1984. It was the Dolphins against the Raiders. It was literally Dwight Stevenson, who's the best center I've ever seen, against Howie Long. And I know I must have watched that film. I must have watched that 100 times. I still have it. Just, I mean, I don't have the projector anymore, but I kept the film. I was like, okay, if I'm going to be a center, I'm going to study the best that's ever played. And just watching that match, I mean, Howie will tell you. You just had Chris Long. Howie will tell you that's the best player he ever played against. So, yeah, I mean, it was always that. But then what I found out when I got in this business, I did the games at Fox for like 12 years on TV, and I do national radio now. I'll be down in New Orleans for this game Sunday. You know, as the analyst, I mean, you might have 12 seconds to talk about a play, and maybe you can make a really poignant point about why it worked, it didn't work, or effort or technique or something, but you're very, very limited. And I just found like it was just a real missing component for fans and players.
Look, I'm sure everybody's asked you about this, and I'm going to ask you as well. What's your thoughts on the new kickoff? You like it? Don't like it?
Okay.
Give me your two cents.
All right, Mickey. So I went to 11 training camps this year. Everybody practiced it. Saw a lot of different things. I saw running backs returning. I saw plays that looked like trap plays where they're kicking out. I saw different types of kicks. And so far it's been kind of a big nothing, right? The team seemed pretty content to put it on the 30. But I talked to a special teams coach where I was this weekend, pretty prominent guy. And he said, Baldy, it's going to evolve. The more these special team coaches get their hands on the tape, how they're doing things. So I feel like it's going to evolve as the season goes on.
Yeah, well, we've been a team in these first two games that we've, you know, basically forced the other team to return it. You know, we're kicking it. We're not kicking it through the end zone. And I think, you know, I don't know that the net is that much different, but I do think that there's a benefit to, you know, forcing the other team to return the kick. Now, part of that is who's the returner, right? And do you want to stay away from them? So, like, if you're a head coach, you're an analytical guy, you're a head coach, are you kicking it and putting it at the 30, or are you forcing them to return it?
Well, here's another component to it. I'm kicking it, and I want my kickoff coverage team to go down there and cover the kick. And I want to keep them around the 20-yard line. Like, that's how I'm covering. So I always believe that kickoff coverage is directly related to how you play defense. Most of the guys covering a kick are defensive players. They're aggressive. They want to be involved in a game. They want to make tackles. They want to beat one-on-one blocks. Like, I think it's an extension of your defense and your defensive mentality.
So early part of the season here, I feel like the run game has all of a sudden gotten a little more prominence. You know, we've spent the last 20 years just focused on passing teams. What's your observation with that regard?
Well, I mean, all the numbers say, Mickey, that the passing numbers are way down. The running is up. I saw Houston beat Indianapolis week one. I saw, you know, Joe Mixon carry it 30 times. I've seen that, you know, that running back in San Francisco, he's carried it, 48 times in two games now. I think the guys that have those type of backs right now that can actually wear you down, what Josh Jacobs did the other day for Green Bay, you put a kid Malik Willis back there and you just feed Josh Jacobs. I mean, that looked like the guy that led the league in rushing 2 years ago. He was a difference maker. I just think the amount of bubble screens and, you know, just all the horizontal passing that we're seeing in the league. And I mean, you guys tackled a bunch of, you know, that stuff right at the line of scrimmage the other day. Dallas didn't really gain much in any of those plays. Like, if that's the passing game, I'd rather hand it off and work on my double teams and powers and things like that inside and put it on the offensive line rather than putting it on my receivers to go block cornerbacks out there.
Yeah, and look, as I'm going to assume this, that you can expound on it. If you're an offensive lineman, every offensive lineman I've ever met, man, they love running the ball, right? It puts them in an aggressive mindset. And so just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the people that know when the defense is breaking down first are the offensive linemen. Like, nobody ever takes getting run on quietly. They're always pointing fingers. They're always bitching. You can break a team's sword by running it down their throats. And the offensive line isn't ever going to celebrate. We're never going to really score, all that stuff. But we know when we are winning the game. We know up front when we're winning it. You got to give us a chance to do it. But we know when we start leaning on these guys, we know, they're not getting off blocks quite as quickly in the fourth quarter as the first quarter. Like, you know when you're wearing a team down. And that's generally when you get the big runs. Like, what you did, you know, this weekend against Dallas was punishing what you did. The way that you hit them with three backs and, you know, the runs by Jamal and and Kamara at the end of that game, I mean, you wore that team down pretty good. And they did a great job the previous week against Cleveland. So I thought that was a real statement in that game, the way that you ran the ball.
Well, look, we got a Duke left guard for us, right? Lucas Patrick, so that helped us.
Oh, he's played well. He's played really well. You know, I mean, it helps that, you know, you drafted a kid from Oregon State in the first round. I haven't quite seen a guy come in the league and do that in a while. So Fuaga is, he looks special to me, Mick. He really does.
Yeah, as I recall, you liked him, you know, during the draft process. I think I remember you talking about him a little bit. Yeah, he's done a good job. And look, he's benefited because we haven't had to, you know, drop back and throw it a lot in obvious passing situations. So, but he's very mature. It's not an easy transition to go from right to left, and yet he's made it look easy.
Well, it's never easy, but I think you've made the two positions stronger. I think Trevor on the right side is better than he was on the left side. He could play more of his style of football. He's just a rare athlete out there. And then his power is just, you just don't see that type of power come into this league very often. I mean, that first block against Derrick Brown, not many people move Derrick Brown in this business. And to see him walk him off the line of scrimmage like he did, you know, it's a testament to, you know, he's going to move people, him and Lucas. You know, it's a good left side right now. I think Trevor's better on the right side. I've known Caesar a long time. He's a Camden kid here, Mickey. We work out in Lane Johnson's backyard. He's come back from a major injury. I saw him down the field on that screen the other day. I didn't know. I had no idea Caesar could run like that, but that was pretty impressive watching him go down the field.
He's one of these guys that, you know, he loves football. And we showed that play at the team meeting on Monday. And, man, he got a lot of cheers when they were showing him running down there with Alvin. That was pretty impressive.
Well, we will see you this weekend. You're part of the national radio team.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate
you. Thanks, Mickey. Yep.
That's our show for tonight. Thanks for listening, everyone. And my thanks to Charlie Long in the booth. As always, this has been the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network.